passion, drive, and patience. What brings home the winning trophy is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. From superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED lights, and more, whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to turn your car into the MVP and bring home that win. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Brandon Thurston from WrestleNomics is up next, and we're going to follow Brandon with John Pollock from Post Wrestling.
Thank you, and good afternoon, everyone.
But we can't ignore the math, okay? We can't ignore the data.
Go on Google Trends, type in your name, then type in mine. You're a straight line. I'm a pyramid.
I like the very direct question on that.
Television ratings, downward spiral. Buy rates, plummeting.
The time is now to turn the math around.
Hello, everybody. It's John Pollock and Brandon Thurston with you live for another edition of Pollock and Thurston. And Brandon, we got the answer to a very obvious question. Why was CM Punk drafted ahead of Drew McIntyre during Monday's draft? As Phil Brooks himself said on live television, it's simple wrestling economics.
Did he say that? Oh,
he did.
Are we going to have like a version two of that intro song then? Because, you know, I'm sure people are always pointing out to you that there's
it has definitely, I feel we have carved out a specific area of the wrestling media lane. Whenever something like wrestling economics is uttered in a promo, right, people do think of us and future. I will have to do a V2 of this intro at some point because it's constantly updating itself. I'm waiting for like MJF to come back to AEW and can cite maybe the decline in live event viewership and maybe cite WrestleTix or something like that.
TV ratings too.
That could all be possible. We could have an announcement of a TV deal by AEW on its own program. So it's like there's all these sound bites to be had potentially.
Right. I'm looking forward to if the NBA does not renew with WBD, I think that that opens up the lane for Tuesday and Thursday for additional AEW programming to be inserted there to, you know, really just fill up that schedule with valuable programming.
Well, I said last week that, and I'm sticking to this, our inevitable path to a 3-hour AEW block
continues tonight.
It continues tonight. And I would say by hour two on Saturday of Collision followed by Rampage, I was thinking to myself, this still feels inevitable, but it is not one that I am racing towards. And as we sit here tonight and, 3 hours tonight, it's a lot. It's a lot of AEW. It's a lot of WWE out there. But we have plenty of topics to get to today. It's a pretty packed week. Before we get into our first topic, which get ready, folks, sit back because the magic words, public records request, have come through for Brandon Thurston. Because yes, as Brandon said last week, he loves documents and he got documents this week.
I certainly did.
Thankfully, none of them were contained on a flash drive that New Japan put all of its fan club members' personal info on and got lost in an arena. There was none of that.
Is that true?
Oh, yes. This was New Japan had to put out a statement that all of this sensitive information was on.
When was this?
This was days ago.
Oh, really?
Yes. If wow. you NJPW1972.com, they say what we will about New Japan and losing USB drives, but I mean, incredibly transparent are they when it comes to losing or at least data being compromised. But on the WrestleMania 41 front, everybody is curious about when the announcement is coming. And I guess Paul Levesque was on. Is it X Spaces now?
I think it's X Spaces. It's Elon Musk's X monetization spaces, something
yes.
like that.
So Paul Levesque was on. I guess they're very cozy together, X and WWE. And Levesque just stated that an announcement about WrestleMania 41's location is coming very, very soon, whatever that means. So that would tell me that they're hoping to get something out relatively quickly.
How soon is very, very soon, do you think?
Well, it's not very soon. It's very, very soon. I would say very, very means this week. Because
this week.
I guess, you know what? When's that WrestleMania 40 documentary coming out? Is that going to be just soon?
In the future, sometime. Yeah.
This Wednesday, right after WrestleMania, as we await. We are now almost a month removed from WrestleMania. But yeah, everyone, I think, assumes now, you know, Las Vegas and Minneapolis are the cities everyone has looked at. And it would seem like Las Vegas, there are there's a lot of, you know, reasoning behind Vegas and the thought that this is getting extended because, you know, Vegas is a very attractive option. And it would be my guess of where this ends up landing for many, many reasons.
We'd been expecting Minnesota for a long time because an executive from, I believe it's the Minnesota Sports Commission, spoke in public to the Minnesota House and was alluding to another big event that they were excited to announce, but were not ready to announce yet. Could have been WrestleMania, but I believe you were just telling me as we were going to air that The Undertaker has reported on this. Is that true?
The Undertaker, on his podcast that he does, I believe weekly, did say...
I'm sorry, 6 Feet Under with Mark Calaway.
Correct. Yes. And I'm sure he was six sources deep on this reporting, stating that he had heard Las Vegas. That's what he's hearing. Okay. What he's hearing. So,
yeah,
everybody make sure that you cite Mark Calaway for this scoop.
Mark Calaway. I'm expecting Las Vegas as well. So that's the impression that I'm getting. So I expect it to be there, and which would lead to lots of excitement and speculation across the sports media universe about the Sphere, and will they do something at the Sphere as part of WrestleMania if they do go to Las Vegas, which you could, I would imagine if that's the case, if they do WrestleMania in Las Vegas, I imagine the events themselves will still be at Allegiant Stadium, the NFL stadium, but it would be interesting to see if they would, you know, as opposed to the MGM Grand Arena or T-Mobile's arena, maybe the Sphere, something there.
Forget the Sphere. What about the UFC Apex? What are we going to get out of the Apex that way?
Apex. I guess NXT could run there. Maybe you could do WWE Speed there or something. I don't know.
Well, that would mean the event would be over quickly. So that would be a positive. Okay. Well, as soon as the WrestleMania announcement is made, we will go from there. Also want to mention, Felix Gutti, who is a reporter out of France. He is going to be representing Post Wrestling this weekend in Lyon at the Backlash event. So he will be there as a media representation, and he's going to join us a little later on in the program. He has put up an article up at Post Wrestling going through the history of WWE in the country of France. He spoke to a number of people involved in the scene in France, why this is a big weekend for WWE in the country, the status of its television distribution in the country. So if you want to check that out, that is up at postwrestling.com, and we'll chat with Felix in about 20 minutes or so.
There's information about subsidies here too, I read.
That is true, yes. We'll speak to Felix too about what he heard from that front. But we go to Greensboro, North Carolina, where Revolution was hosted back in March, all centered around the retirement of Sting. And my very first question, Brandon, is AEW suing Greensboro, the city of Greensboro?
Well, if they are, it's too late.
It's sensitive information that got out. Have trade secrets now been leaked? Do we know that the cost of cleaning up confetti being $500, is that the going rate? Has AEW swindled Greensboro when we know that's a $1,000 job?
Yeah, there were many headlines that were pitched here at the WrestleNomics editorial newsroom, such as, you know, Tony Khan spends hundreds of dollars on towels. That is an itemized item. I don't think it's in the things that I published today, but I think that's a normal thing that you spend some money on.
Is this the most detailed breakdown you've gotten in terms of a live event, in terms of like that level of minutia that has been contained, or have you encountered this in other
public
records?
It might be. I mean, this is a settlement event, a settlement document. I want to say I've seen settlements before, but it's in a lot of detail in terms of the expenses, which I think. So what we learn from this is that here's all the things that the Greensboro Coliseum, which is a government venue. That's why we got this. Here's all the things that they charged AEW for the box office service. They charged them $55,000 for rent. They charged them for stagehands, which was $79,000. This was IATSE. These were union people, which is often the case when you run at some venues. You've got to use union people. So they were charged in total $192,000 or so. I imagine that there were Well, there certainly were other expenses that were related to running this pay-per-view. So it's hard to itemize all that in terms of not only, yeah, you got to pay your talent and you do your catering and you have to have the broadcast, you know, sent out across pay-per-view. So you have to pay your crew. So I imagine that the cost was well over $200,000 to run this pay-per-view. I would think it's closer to $1 million, but they did run, you know, draw $1 million just based on ticket sales. In terms of net revenue after the fees and everything, they sold $951,000, but including the fees and the sales tax, they did draw over $1 million, in terms of actual ticket sales. There's the document that says, there it is, $1 million for Sting's retirement match. And of course they drew revenue probably, you know, well in excess of $1 million in terms of pay-per-view.
Yeah. And it's a great breakdown because so often we hear that WWE typically doesn't extract or they do include the Ticketmaster fees into their live gate figure. Here you get an actual sample of like how much are those fees that go into this as well. So, I mean, yeah, grossing over $1 million for Sting's final match. And the question as well that everyone had, do we know what the scan count was? What was the turnstile count, Brandon?
We do have a turnstile count for this event.
Wait a minute. All these venues monitor this stuff. This was not just some one-off.
They do. As we know, there's a turnstile count for WrestleMania 32 with its announced number of 101,768. The turnstile count was, what was it? 80,000 some odd. Anyway, this event had 16,118 tickets distributed, only 281 comps. The rest were sold. So that's 15,000 plus tickets sold. Of all those tickets that were distributed, they distributed every ticket. And we've got emails here that I didn't publish. We've got just, did you get a chance to look over any of that? We've got just hundreds of emails between City of Greensboro personnel and AEW personnel. This is a show that did very well in the early days of the sale. So they were freeing up sections constantly. They were deciding to increase the capacity and minimize the stage and all that. So anyway, 87% of the tickets distributed were actually scanned. Only about half of the comps showed up, but 87 overall out of all the tickets distributed. And one of the takeaways I have here is that as a percentage of tickets sold to the tickets scanned, that's about 80, what did I write in here? 88%, 89%, which is very, very close to the percentage, you know, the ratio of the all-in number that they announced, 81,031, to the dreaded turnstile count, the infamous turnstile count of 72,265 for all-in in London last year. So that does encourage the belief that, you know, AEW is being honest there with that announced ticket sales number.
Well, I do hope this follow up and we get the extensive autopsy on the history of Starrcade in Greensboro from this. I mean, what else is at our disposal here from the Greensboro Coliseum?
That's a good question. I mean, you could go, but hey, do you have records from 1983?
So what I thought of here was I knew you were pursuing this. I didn't realize you were going to get this level of detail where I basically need to upgrade my system for this this email download that they have.
Do you have Adobe Acrobat?
I do. Yes.
Okay, well then you're good to go. But I did request this like the next day after the event. It just took this long, as governments tend to take a while to get back to you.
I mean, we're talking what, 8 weeks, like less. That's a fairly quick
almost
turnaround.
2 months. Yeah.
Yeah. So a good turnaround. Greensboro, I think, gets the WrestleNomics thumbs up.
Okay.
Let's talk a bit about our favorite topic, AEW's television. What does this mean as we will focus on every NBA television package related story and how this trickles down to affect AEW? The Wall Street Journal reporting that Comcast, the parent company of NBC, is prepared to make a $2.5 billion per year offer to get the NBA rights away from TNT. Now, the current average annual value of TNT's package is $1.2 billion. So we're talking more than double for this proposal that Comcast is expected to put forth. And this comes right after the exclusive negotiating window ended, and Comcast is free to swoop in. WBD does have the ability to match any third-party bid, but if this is the expected amount that NBC is prepared to offer, I mean, it puts WBD into a pretty contentious situation where you either have to gigantically increase your amount to retain the NBA, which is expected to be a smaller package regardless, for double the amount, because Amazon is going to be carved into this next picture as well. So all of this, the big focus now is on WBD and what is their future with the NBA going to be. If they want to stay in the NBA business, this is going to be an enormous price tag that it comes with.
Right. So the big deal here is that TNT charges, just to Google it, this information that I'm about to say is not public, but there's various, I don't know, media outlets that have speculated or estimated what the cost is. So TNT is maybe around $3 per month to your cable system. So you pay your cable bill, and then your cable system, your cable system pays TNT $3 per subscriber to have TNT on the system. $3 per subscriber is pretty high because a lot of people watch TNT. You got a lot of important live programming on TNT, including the NBA, which is by far the most valuable property that TNT has. And if there's no NBA that's a part of the next round, it's going to be harder to justify $3 per subscriber. So it leaves a lot of questions around, what impact will this have if they don't get NBA games? What impact will this have on the business of WBD and on the business of TNT? So, I don't know. It will make, let's imagine a world where, the NBA is not on TNT. What effect will that have on AEW? On one hand, and I think you did a good job the other night of sort of pointing out, the pluses and minuses here. On one hand, you'd have a lower profile network if you don't have, the second most valuable sports property that there is. On the other hand, if they keep it, if they don't keep it, well, there's extra money maybe to go around. Maybe they would be more apt to make sure that lots of AEW content stays, and maybe AEW gets a better deal because of that. But if they do pay up and pay a big increase for this, when you adjust it for the number of games, however many games they retain, that's really gonna tighten their budget, I would think. And then it leads you to wonder if they will have a lot of money left over to give AEW the deal that AEW is hoping that it gets.
Yeah. So that's really where it comes down to, is like, this is, in theory, like TNT, they are so tied. Their identity is the NBA. So to lose that, the carriage fees become such a big component here, and you're kind of doing a risk reward analysis of what potential losses you could face by the loss of the NBA, although your money going out is going to be dramatically lessened if you have the NBA off your books. So it's a very extreme form of calculus to figure out if you're Warner Brothers Discovery. And it goes right to the crux of the question of what is our 5-year strategy when it comes to cable, if it's without the NBA. Like, certainly they have Major League Baseball on TBS. They still have the men's tournament for the NCAA. Like, they're still involved in sports, but this greatly changes that strategy if we're talking about your 5-year plan with the NBA versus without the NBA, and how much of a presence they're going to have when it comes to bidding on these larger sports rights if they're out of the game for the NBA. And like, they are not going to be anchoring their primetime profile with professional wrestling and other sports mixed in. I mean, it would be, it'll just be a sizable change. And even if they retain the NBA, I mean, it'll be an enormous pressure on them with the amount that it will cost to stay at the table with these other broadcasters.
Yeah, I wonder if they do lose the NBA, their average subscriber, their subscriber fee has got to go down. Does, in that scenario, or even in a scenario where they have less NBA, which seems fairly likely at this point, does having AEW help at all with TNT justifying their carriage fees? And I don't know the answer to that question, because we're already at a point here where AEW is, I would say, almost certainly not covering their rights fee with ad revenue. So you have to be, if you're WBD, considering AEW's value to go something beyond ad revenue, whatever that is, whether it is carriage fees, whether it's marketing value, I don't know. So you're already justifying it. If you are justifying it, you're justifying it something beyond ad revenue. Does that tension of NBA being gone and the rights fee being, you know, distressed, does AEW help with that at all? I don't know the answer to the question. But it does leave open Tuesday and Thursday for one thing, for shows to go on different nights. We don't know where WWE is going to end up in terms of Raw, SmackDown. They could go on any night, NXT as well. So is AEW going to end up in a position where it's opposed? Opening up Tuesday and Thursday without the NBA there would give some more freedom there. Maybe you could have, you know, Tuesday night Titans program with Tony Khan or something like that, and he could, you know, just, you know, promote the next night's AEW Dynamite. You can think of lots of programming ideas.
Yeah, I can't even imagine what the schedule is going to look like for next year. And before we even get to 2025, I mean, the Netflix deal got reported in January, and here we are at the start of May. And I would have thought for sure back in January that by May we would know what the situation would be for Raw for the final quarter of this year. And that still remains a question mark about Raw's status after its deal ends September 30th. Like, I thought for sure we would get some announcement of what that Band-Aid solution will be for the final 3 months of this year, and there's been no update.
I would think what's most likely, maybe just a three month extension for USA Network, since it's not like that relationship is ending. They're going to keep SmackDown.
That's what I would think. I mean, USA would want it. You would think WWE would want it. I just figured, like, would we have 3 months that would go by where that wouldn't just, okay, we're going to tack on. We've worked a short-term agreement to get us to the end of the year. Like, that seems rather, that doesn't sound like the most complicated deal when we're talking about just completing one for your near worldwide rights with Netflix in comparison. But I believe Raw is going to air for 3 months. It's just interesting that's taken this long to get some announcement out. But maybe it too is going to be announced very, very soon. Maybe very, very, very soon.
Yeah, I don't know. I imagine whatever the issue is, it's not essential to WWE that they make a deal on that sooner than later. And maybe waiting, they see as advantaging them somehow in a negotiation. I don't know.
I mean, they've already given the guidance that they are kind of not expecting anything.
Yeah, they're not
3 months
making any revenue in there. Yeah.
So anything is gravy if they have that deal, because I don't imagine them giving the Raw rights away domestically. While we're on that front, I will forget this at the end of the show, so I'll alert people that next week WWE is going to be holding or TKO, we should say, is holding their earnings call next Wednesday evening. So rather than doing a show a few hours before the earnings call, we're going to go live Thursday next week at 3 Eastern, the day after the earnings call, so we can hear and react to the quarterly report, the earnings call, and we'll see what Mark Shapiro has to say and Ari Emanuel.
Yes. I think there's a Endeavor call the next day or the prior day where they will take no questions, maybe for one of the last times here as they work to go private.
Oh, that's right. They're really mimicking Paramount this week. What was it?
Yes, I did listen to that live. Yeah.
You did listen
to that? Yeah. Mission Impossible music before and after.
Wow. Yeah. 8 minutes. We're taking no questions. Unbelievable. Yes. Like the lack of just anything that they would address. Before we welcome our guest, let's chat about Dwayne The Rock Johnson, who I can confirm he was not scheduled to join us at 3 p.m. He is, to what I understand, wherever he is, he's on schedule. This was a pretty scathing piece by The Wrap. It was written by Umberto Gonzalez, who stated he spoke to more than a dozen insiders directly involved with the film that was set to be released last Christmas and has been pushed to this year's Christmas season, the Amazon MGM film Red One, that has reportedly ballooned to a budget over $250 million. And it characterizes a lot of people who are not speaking on the record for a fear of reprisals, that Dwayne Johnson has said to have a chronic issue with lateness and a lack of professionalism on set to and on-set problems due to the producer's inexperience with Hiram Garcia, who is has been tagged as the lead producer on this project. He certainly does not come out of this article either looking too positive. It should be worth noting that people connected with both WWE and with the film itself and Seven Bucks Productions did respond to questions on this. They are denying some of the accusations made here against Dwayne Johnson, but certainly you could look at this and it definitely paints Johnson and trying to establish kind of a pattern throughout. This is not just isolated to this particular production, but it goes back years to stories from the set of Ballers, tying it into his fallout with Vin Diesel a number of years ago, and also painting kind of just Hiram Garcia being placed in this role due to his relationship with Johnson and being in over his head, as this article would paint it.
And Hiram Garcia is the brother of Danny Garcia, who is Rock's ex-wife, who's That's still his right. business partner, though. Yeah. I mean, it, when I read it, I thought of, well, where's this WrestleMania documentary? That sort of adds up that, you know, there's all these issues around lateness and not really being organized to do things on time. And we had a Rock. Well, what was the reporting or the line about it? That this was a very Rock influenced documentary that was supposed to be released about the build up to WrestleMania and all of the creative things that were involved in that, right? And that was announced that was going to be released. What was the Wednesday after WrestleMania?
The Wednesday after WrestleMania. So we're looking at what, April 10th, I think that would have been. So, you know, we're almost a month removed from WrestleMania coming up.
Yeah. And where's that? Not completed. So yeah, it points and look at, there's, I mean, other similarities here in terms of he's bringing in certain, people to work with him. And I thought of, you know, that contract that we saw where, his contract to work with WWE, where he's got somebody baked in there as a writer, as a creative, seems pretty likely that that's Brian Gewirtz, but, it's redacted in there. So, you know, he's got a lot of people who are, you know, part of his team that he makes sure are included here.
Now, the WWE side of this, it did state, you know, people that had stated the one about him being late for an appearance at WWE The World. I mean, that one is not disputed at all. I heard from people that were at this event, and I mean, you even have video of The Rock.
That wasn't part of the show. That wasn't intentional. So, right. Yeah.
Yes, not intentional. And Johnson even like video of him, you know, remarking in his promo to the audience about being late. So that one is not really being disputed. However, there's another one about him being several hours late for, presumably the first night of WrestleMania when he had the match in the main event. And this generated not just a response from WWE, an on the record response from WWE.
On the record.
With Chris LeGentle, WWE's executive vice president for talent relations and head of communications, who said, quote, Dwayne was not only on time for WrestleMania, he was hours early to help with rehearsal and a pleasure to work with throughout the entire run. I hope that there's at least like a subset of wrestling veterans that are just aghast at Chris LeGentle breaking kayfabe and mentioning rehearsals. But you also, maybe being the one person, your biggest takeaway here was Chris LeGentle now has an EVP title.
He got a promotion.
Yes.
Which is consistent with the news that we know of, that he's now very involved with talent relations, which it says here, right? It says executive vice president for talent relations and head of communications. So previously senior vice president, now executive vice president.
Yeah. The other things noted here, I mean, we don't have to go into this, but man, was there a lot of time spent on Dwayne Johnson.
The Voss bottles?
The final Voss, Dwayne Johnson. Johnson would show up as much as 8 hours late, made a habit of peeing in a water bottle to save time, which upset crew members, one insider stated. Quote, he pees in a Voss water bottle and his team or a PA has to dispose of it. If there is not a brand integration of Voss into Seven Bucks Productions, then I don't know what to expect here. We also learned Johnson's publicist, Meredith O'Sullivan, that I'm sure had a fantastic day on Tuesday regarding this. But anyway,
To set the record straight, though, two people close to the production denied to the Wrap that Johnson had ever asked a production assistant or other member of his team to dispose of a bottle of urine on set, okay? He has never asked anybody to do that.
They're not disputing that the man might piss in the occasional water bottle, but he does not have his production assistants dispose of said piss.
yes, thank you.
I don't know.
Clarify.
Maybe it's because like some of the stories we've been covering of late Brandon, like they're pretty harrowing to talk about. And this here, it's like, okay, guys, probably not always timely. There is certainly a cost that comes with it. But I also look at this and it's just to me, I don't sense that there is a grand scandal attached to this. But you can certainly look at this in terms of overall, like a picture being painted of Dwayne Johnson over time that we had remarked kind of this guy has crafted a very protected image of himself. And that we have seen cracks over the number of years attached to this, whether it be, you know, business failings with Black Adam, for instance, that was supposed to be this big vehicle for him. And now you're getting, you know, something like this where, I mean, you're talking about more than a half dozen insiders speaking on behalf of this. Like, it is giving people just conflicting experiences with Dwayne Johnson.
And you had someone who's a member of crew say that because he spent so much time in his trailer that this person qualified for health insurance because you have to do a certain amount of time here in the United States to qualify for health insurance. So it sounds like he's become more difficult to work with, or he's, you know, he's taking more time for himself and letting everybody wait.
Okay. So everyone gets on Obamacare, but no one was aware of RoccoCare. Okay. That's how you qualify. We will bring on someone who I'm sure has health benefits from his part of the world. We are welcomed by Felix Guti, who is joining us. Where are we today? In France? Are you in Lyon as we speak? Where are you, Felix?
I'm currently in Paris, and there's a big thunder outside. It's Labor Day here in France, so I'm all yours.
Okay, well, we appreciate you joining us. There's a great piece up at postwrestling.com where Felix has gone through kind of the history of pro wrestling and specifically WWE in the country of France as we lead up to two nights in Lyon with SmackDown on Friday night, which will be a rare tape-delayed version of SmackDown that we'll get here in the U.S. and Canada, and then, of course, Backlash on Saturday. So, I mean, Felix, do you get the sense that, like, how big does this feel, like the coverage that you're seeing over there as we are just a couple of days out from the event? Does this feel like a major event within the kind of the wrestling scene in France?
Well, outside of the wrestling bubble, it doesn't seem big at all. There's no coverage in the sport or mainstream media in France so far, aside from the initial announcement late last year. As far as the wrestling media goes, I think they are clinching to every bit of news. Last I checked, there was rumors that John Cena appeared in a city in France or at least in Europe. So maybe he's there. I don't know.
Oh.
But maybe for an announcement. I don't know. So I think it's very consecrated to the wrestling media bubble so far. Maybe later this week we'll have a guest appear on a talk show on national TV. I know the biggest talk show on national TV here in France called Quotidien, Daily, pokes fun at WWE at least once a year. So I think they want to have someone from WWE to plug the show, but I don't know yet.
Thanks for joining us, Felix. I recognize you, I think, mainly as your Twitter avatar. I think we've interacted on Twitter a few times. I was like, oh, yes, this is the right person. So it's nice to finally meet you.
And my mustache is there, too.
Yes. One of my big takeaways here from reading your article is that you confirmed that Backlash didn't receive any public subsidies. And when I heard that this show was happening in Lyon, France, you know, that's not a city that I, as a dumb American, recognize. I figured there's got to be a tourism board involved here in terms of, you know, encouraging economics to go towards this municipality. So I was surprised by that, and I thought that was, you know, one of the bigger takeaways, and it leads me to wonder more you know, skeptically towards maybe some of the other international PLEs in terms of whether they have site fees associated with them.
I was surprised too, because Lyon is a big city, the third most populated city in France. It's a big economic city. But WWE has been there 6 times, according to Cage Match. And I was surprised too, because Paris was always the go-to for WWE to stage a show, certainly for two shows of that magnitude and historical significance. Paris was the city to be, but so I tried to dig into to Lyon's metropolitan authorities, to the department, the district, to the region, and the Lyon Metropolis, who regulates activities in several cities around Lyon, including Décines, where Backlash and SmackDown will take place, were the only ones to really wanted to provide an answer and to say, no, we haven't given any money on our part. But I don't know if it's the case on every front. But
you say, is it possible that there's another government organization that might have paid for a site fee, but this one says it didn't?
Yes, exactly. Okay. My assumption, if there is in fact no subsidies involved, my assumption is that maybe WWE is testing the waters before staging a bigger show, maybe in years to come, and maybe trying to prove themselves in Lyon economically, to try and appeal to maybe Paris or other big cities in France to try and apply to the local authorities for subsidies.
Yeah, maybe we'll see an economic impact study after this.
Yes.
You talked about it a bit in the article, but if you can just explain as well for people outside of France, what is the current kind of television distribution for WWE in the country? And does the Netflix deal impact any of that next year?
Currently in France, there's access to the WWE network still. And the main broadcaster is a cable channel called AB1, who comprises every program WWE puts out, like Raw, SmackDown, NXT, shows like WWE Rivals, even Young Rock. They're very hands down. They're very involved in WWE, in broadcasting WWE, including pay-per-views, because AB1 will broadcast Backlash with a 3 days delay, and I think as far as I know, the current contract deal is scheduled for the next several years with AB1. I don't know the exact number. I tried to reach out to them, but they didn't answer me. As far as I understand it, the Netflix deal begins in January of next year, but only if the current contract is not running. So maybe it will be a delay in France to see Raw and other programming on Netflix.
And how would you compare the distribution for AEW? Like how much, like if AEW were to go to France, does it have enough of momentum that would... That would be successful for AEW, or is it a big difference between the two at the moment?
AEW currently is on one cable channel called Warner TV Next, or Toonami in France too. But it's not as well known as AB1. AB1 is part of a big media group in France. AB1 is a very old cable channel who was free at the beginning of its history. So the distribution is much more larger. I think it's different now comparing it maybe with the brief period where TNA were broadcast in France in 2009-2010, because there's the power of social media and the internet. I think many more fans of wrestling in France are are well acquainted with AEW, so it would be maybe easier to stage a house show in France for AEW. But I think it would be pretty difficult. And also, WWE has a very historical power in France, like they have in the UK or Germany. So it's very difficult task to go up against that for AEW.
Yeah. Would you say that as we've experienced an increase in popularity in WWE in North America, and would you say it's been similar in France? I know there was the house show last year, April, that did over 12,000 tickets distributed. So is that something that's happening in France as well?
I don't really know if it's that happening in France. I think the fan base is maybe more vocal, more passionate, I should say. It's a little bit cliche to say that, but I don't know if there is more fans today than before, like in the late 2000, early 2010s. But I think with all social media, with the WWE network and so forth, there is a generation of fans that are very passionate and are very inclined to share their passion among other people. And I think that's the community effect that goes on. And what you have seen last year was really that kind of community power, much more than just a movement and a movement towards more fans getting into WWE.
Now, you're going to be there on Saturday as media. What kind of are you expecting just going as a media member for one of these events? And do we know about the status of the press conference? Are we getting a press conference on Saturday, Felix?
So far, I have not received any answer about my participation at the post-show press conference. I'm expecting it on Friday, I think. I've been to only one other WWE show with a press credential. That was the NXT house show in 2018 in Paris, with roundtables with Adam Cole and other superstars. I don't really know what to expect on Saturday. LDLC Arena is a big and very modern arena, as I can understand it.
It's a new arena too, right?
Yes, it's a very new arena. They have very big ambition, as I understand it, for their events. They want a lot of events. So I really don't know. I think the future is in balance, I say, the future of WWE in France. Maybe we can expect an announcement or something for the future of WWE in France as far as show goes, but I don't know. And for the wrestling part of it, I'm personally looking forward to see Cody Rhodes defending his title now that he has finished his story against a veteran like AJ Styles. I think two stars that wasn't really a part of that really big movement in the late 2000s and early 2010s. Cody debuted in 2007, so he was very young at the time. But I think it will be pretty interesting to see.
Well, I hope that there's a press conference, because I know from his days as Jean-Paul Levesque, yeah. Triple H speaks French, right? So he could take all the questions and answers in French.
I don't know if he really speaks French. But that's weird, because you spoke about Chris Legento in France. In French, it means the nice one, so I don't know.
Oh, does it?
But I expect to see to have the opportunity to ask some question to Paul Levesque regarding the subsidies situation, maybe. I don't know.
All right. Well, Felix, I want to thank you very much for joining us. Again, you can go up to postwrestling.com. He's got an extensive piece called Nearly 20 Years of French Wrestling History Surrounds Backlash France. And we look forward to having a a post-show report from you up on the site on Sunday. So you can look out for that on the post-wrestling site. So all the best this weekend, Felix, and thanks so much for taking some time out to chat with us.
Thank you for having me, guys. It's an honor personally to be with you.
Thanks so much, Felix.
Pleasure to have you on. Thanks, Felix. All right, Felix Guti joining us. So yes, he will be there on the ground on behalf of us this coming weekend. A Saturday afternoon show, no less, that is going down. All right, we have some other topics to get to. We're going to focus on the Vince McMahon, Janelle Grant story. Last week, we had reported that Vince McMahon has retained the services of Citric & Company, which I have been doing some reading over the last week, Brandon. I have been going through The Fixer by Michael Citric. So I'm going to hold off on my book review until next week's show, but I will have a review of this.
Have you not read it completely yet?
I am not done it yet, but I am halfway through the Fixer. It's a fascinating book, to say the least. So
yes,
that is on the Kindle as we speak. Maybe you can get the book on tape version, Brandon.
Maybe. Is there an audio version with I prefer to listen to audiobooks if it's the author reading the book. So hopefully I can find something like that. I did read an article with like his rules for PR. He's got like, say, like 10 rules or something like that.
Yes. Yeah. So the construction of the book is sort of taking these different cases and applying these rules of when they come into place. And he's pretty guarded about not necessarily naming like certain companies, but others he was like, this guy was enlisted when Michael Jackson died to like handle like the estate. I mean, he's been involved some extremely high profile cases and situations, and he is the one that has been enlisted by Vince McMahon in this whole case. But you've kind of been going through the non-disclosure agreement that Janelle Grant signed in early 2022, and the crux of this dispute is Janelle Grant's side arguing that this NDA was invalidated and thus she should not be held to it. Vince McMahon's side, as we got the statement last week, believing that this was broken and any disputes need to be handled in litigation and thus
in arbitration.
And this is through the NDA, the language that needs to be adhered to. So that is, you know, the source of this conflict. And you've kind of gone through different thoughts on how this NDA could or could not be valid based on several pieces of evidence that we know to be out there.
Yeah. And I have one very specific thought that I want to go through, but just to review the reasons why Janelle Grant says this NDA is not enforceable. There's five of them. She says that, this is her lawyer, Ann Callis, writing the complaint, right? In back in January, she says that this NDA is too broad. It's not specific enough about what to not disclose and what to not disparage about. Number two is that they say that Janelle Grant agreed to this under duress and that there was a disproportionate amount of power that Vince had relative to her. There's revisions that she says she proposed, but that Vince was in a big hurry to pressure her to just get this done. Number four is that they say that the NDA is one-sided. It's only requiring Grant to be to adhere to a non-disclosure agreement and not Vince. They're also pointing out that, okay, it was a $3 million NDA, but look at all the other NDAs. They don't put it in this specific language, but they do say that, look, she got an NDA payment that was lower than others who were in similar situations. And I assume that they're alluding to the NDAs that we know about, including the $7.5 million NDA with a WWE talent who alleges sexual misconduct in 2005. We know that Rita Chatterton also signed a multi-million dollar NDA. We don't know the value of it though, in any case. And then number five is the new legislation, the Speak Out Act, which invalidates NDA clauses. And basically, you know, McMahon's memorandum in support of their movement to compel, they're saying that, you know, all of these things that you raise are invalid. You know, you're challenging things that are not pertinent to the arbitration clause. You're challenging the NDA clause. You're not challenging the arbitration clause. And I think what they want to get across here is that this is a contract And the sole clause in this contract is not just NDA. It's not just about non-disparagement, non-disclosure. This is a contract with various agreements in it, including arbitration. If there's any issue between us here relating to this contract, we're supposed to go arbitration. So they're trying to dismiss a number of these reasons why the NDA shouldn't be enforceable, is that this doesn't pertain to the arbitration clause in particular. And then on the Speak Out Act, Jessica Rosenberg, who is McMahon's lawyer, points out that the Speak Out Act pertains to pre-dispute NDAs, which I think most classically would refer to, let's say, you know, you get hired into a new job, and as part of your in-processing, they make you sign an NDA that you will not disparage and not disclose certain things, and then you're a victim of sexual misconduct. It would invalidate any enforceability over that NDA in a case such as that. And the text of the Speak Out Act is consistent with that. It refers to pre-dispute non-disclosure agreements. There's some language in here about it pertaining to things that happen before a dispute arises. So that all seems compelling. And then I realized, you know, the other day that, you know, if you look at the timing of this, and this NDA, which Vince has provided a signed copy of it as an exhibit to his filings, it was signed on January 28th, 2022. And then we know from Grant's complaint, though, that after the NDA was signed, that she was assaulted one more time by Vince when she went to his condo, as she describes it, to review outstanding business items. And he assaults her, basically. We don't need to read it, but that's in the complaint. And then there's also some scenes that are described after that on March 2nd, 2022 and March 4th. And March 27th, involving WWE superstar and text messages between Brock Lesnar, who we know to be Brock Lesnar, and Janelle Grant, that are also after the NDA is signed. So I don't know if this rises to sexual misconduct or harassment. I suppose you could say that you could argue that it does, because she's arguing that that interacting with Lesnar was in line with McMahon's instructions, and that he was exuding power over her. But, you know, at a minimum, we do have a description of a sexual assault here that occurs, according to her, after the NDA, which makes it seem to me then what we've got here, if a dispute is, I think we need to do like some clarification, and I'm not a lawyer, of course, so I could be off about this for some obvious reason, but what we've got here is a dispute, a disagreement about this NDA that comes after most of, you know, The agreement is made after most of the misconduct, the alleged misconduct, has occurred. But then we do have this, at least one event, after the NDA is agreed to. So that may be something that Grant's side will argue, who knows, but I could see that as a persuasive reason why Speak Out at might apply here and thus make the NDA not enforceable.
And it's a major point of contention, not just for how this case proceeds and what forum it's going to be potentially heard in front of, but if in fact this NDA is ruled to be invalidated, I mean, it opens up so many questions to other NDAs. I mean, especially on the case of if one of the arguments, such as it being too broad, were to be agreed upon by a judge, you know, over time, I would imagine the language in these NDAs has gotten more specific, not less specific. So if we're talking about, we're going back a decade plus to other NDAs as well, like what does that place any of those NDAs in? The key difference being, we can assume that the other NDAs did not have defaulted payments attached to them as well. But I mean, it is a broader question too about, especially when you're talking about the Speak Out Act and how this could apply to others that we know exist. This is not one instance of an NDA being signed by someone attached to Vince McMahon.
Yes. So there's that.
All right. We will follow that. And again, the next deadline is John Laurinaitis's to respond to the case that is May the 14th. So yeah, sometime before then.
And actually, I think we can say this. We did get just now, in fact, confirmation that Janelle Grant does have a law degree, a JD that she earned in 2009 from Pace University. So questions around whether she actually had a law degree, which were kind of alluded to in McMahon's memorandum of support of motion to compel, I want to get the actual language here. What did they actually say? It's incredulous that plaintiff, then a 42-year-old woman who claims on her resume to have a law degree from Pace University, would have written these words to defendant. They're referring to the love letter months after. So it's a short sentence, and I believe that's the only allusion to it. But according to Pace University, she does have a degree, a law degree.
Yes. All right. Well, that was that literally just came in, so we have that for you. Exclusive here on the show. You know, Brandon, there's a question that I feel you and I offline, we are always asking each other on a weekly basis. If only we could have the answer. Who killed WCW?
And yes,
this is the question that Dwayne Johnson clearly has been on his mind as well, because Vice has announced a new series. Who killed WCW? They're going for a single assailant. It'll premiere on June the 4th, as confirmed by Deadline. And from Andrew Thompson here, Dwayne The Rock Johnson and Danny Garcia of Seven Bucks Productions are executive producing the docuseries. The show will take a look at the company's downfall, management challenges, creative decisions, and the Monday Night War between WCW and WWF/E. Alongside Johnson and Garcia, joining them in producing the series will be Brian Gewirtz, Vice TV's Lee Hoffman, Evan Husney, and Jason Eisner, the latter two being, of course, the producers of Dark Side of the Ring. And this will be in the same Dark Side of the Ring time slot on Tuesday nights at 10, beginning June 4th with a four-week run. And there is a trailer.
That's only a month away. That's happening very soon then, huh?
Very soon, yeah. This will be Dark Side ends next week. So there will be, a three-week gap, and then this will start. And the trailer, it's interesting if you watch this trailer. And again, we're going off 60 seconds here. But what I found interesting was no, actual footage here of WCW. Like, it all feels like it's like camcorder footage, or it's like still photos. And I'd just be curious if they actually, you would think, given the connection here, that they will have footage in this series. But it was interesting from the trailer that it did not seem to be actual WWE-owned footage of WCW programming. But we will see. But they have everybody surrounding this. I mean, this will be just engagement mana, to coin a term, from Eric Bischoff, Bret Hart, Bill Goldberg. I really hope Bret Hart lets loose in this series. I hope so. I hope he doesn't shy away and picks a side of where he stands. Kevin Nash. I mean,
I did see there's a tweet from Kevin Nash. He's responding to somebody who's being kind of skeptical about, you know, this topic being, you know, have a documentary about it again. And he says, no, we told our story, not the WWE Victor's version. This will be the real take. So this is the real story.
According to
Kevin Nash.
Okay. I thought I got the real story on commentary during that Triple H Sting match at WrestleMania a few years ago. I mean, that was quite the ending, wasn't it? I mean, what's your sense of, like, here we are 23 years removed from the last Nitro, and here we are revisiting it. I mean, we just had a ECW nostalgia Dark Side of the Ring last night. I mean, this is an era that is very, very romanticized, and I'm sure that Seven Bucks Productions are leaning on that fact that there's still this giant audience, relative audience out there that still has an appetite for this kind of content. I don't know if it's necessarily for me, but I'm sure that there are some that will be diving into this.
Yeah, it fuels my suspicion that there's a nostalgia sweet spot for people in terms of this era that's like after cable TV, after the VCR, but before video on demand and Netflix and stuff like that, that there were just the right amount of entertainment options that really struck people and you know, invested all this nostalgia. And that's definitely WCW. I wonder if we'll get AEW documentaries someday about, you know, the creation of AEW or something like that, or whatever happens there. But I think there's something to what Kevin Nash is saying there, right? That some of these W documentaries, you know, as technically well done as they may be, present a WWE favorable narrative because they're being created by WWE, and you don't want to create anything that the boss is going to object to. So you get a WWE point of view on the story.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of great stuff out there if you want to do some research ahead of time. I mean, you know, there was the Death of WCW book. There was the Guy Evans book on called Nitro that came out a number of years ago. David Bixenspan and Chris Zellner Did about 85 hours into the history of WCW. That is definitely worth your time to go through and kind of go.
Will Jamie Kellner be interviewed?
Jamie Kellner would be a great person to get, and I think would be. I'm more so interested if they get any of those figures. Like with due respect to Vince Russo and Eric Bischoff and such. I mean, we have heard from a lot of these people. I would be more so interested in some of those figures. And they are promoting the fact executives as well, but that could be a wide range of people. We'll see.
Yeah, unfortunately, I don't think Ted Turner is in shape to participate. But some of the TV executives would definitely be fascinating.
Some ratings notes we will go back to. So Friday night, it was the draft edition of SmackDown that did 2,143,000 viewers and a 0.58 in the 18 to 49 demographic, going up against the second night of the NFL draft. And SmackDown did its lowest viewership all year long, lowest in the demo. On top of that, they were down 8% from the same week from the prior week, going against NBA and NHL competition as well. I think it is very safe to say that the draft, like there was a time that the draft was a difference maker, that they could do a big number for once a year. I think we are well past that, and it has only been confirmed year after year after year. But I imagine it's a concept that they will stick to. I just sense so little buzz for these drafts going in or coming out of it.
Well, there's very little wrestling on the show, right? There's something like, 12 minutes of wrestling, I heard. Is that correct?
Yeah, there were some
couple very short matches.
So, yeah, it was very low, especially on SmackDown on Friday, where you're cramming in all these picks and talking segments, throwing around a handful of matches as well.
Yeah, so the draft was on three networks, right? It was on ABC, where it did, let's call it, 2.7 million viewers. And then it was also on ESPN2, where it did an additional 1.6 million. And then it was on the NFL Network, where it did almost 800,000 viewers. So I think I totaled it something like almost 5 million viewers or something like that. So that's strong competition. In terms of the demo, did it do close to what it did on ABC? It did pretty close to what it did on ABC. And I guess that's where that neck and neck comment is coming from, in terms of it being close on the overnight fast affiliates, which is, I don't know what it was in the fast affiliates, but it finaled out at 5.8 as opposed to the ABC telecast of the draft as 6.1. Of course, if you stacked on top of ABC, the ESPN and the NFL Network, it's well over what SmackDown did. But if we're only looking at the fast affiliates, then it is pretty close.
Those fast affiliates, Brandon. Can't rely on fast affiliates. Collision Saturday night was followed by Rampage, so we had another 3-hour block, and this was the Collision. It started at 8:23 p.m. because they were following the Celtics Miami Heat game, so that led to
a blowout.
Yeah, it was a giant first quarter for for the first 6 minutes, we should state, that they had an enormous audience for that opening couple of minutes, and the show ended up doing 621,000 viewers and a 0.21 in the demo, but things certainly subsided throughout the night, and by Rampage that hour doing 293,000 and a 0.09 in the demo. So this was not a case of Rampage getting that big bump just by following following Collision. This was one where I just looked at this and yeah, they got the big bump at the beginning. I think the audience, they're cool for 2 hours of wrestling. A third, it's a bit of a slog for people on a Saturday night.
I'm still curious if there's some systematic factor at play here in terms of making the Rampage quarters, the Rampage portion of this consecutive telecast do worse. I would be really curious to see if they actually programmed a 3-hour Dynamite or even a 3-hour Collision, if we don't see such a drop in that final hour.
I think it would only help. I think like it tells you just like Rampage is considered like it's bonus content, that if you want more wrestling,
it would be a messaging thing. But I do wonder if there's like DVR scheduling that's encouraging this as well.
That could also be part of it as well. You know, you did see, well, I'm remembering back to in Toronto when they did the same experiment with Rampage following, and they had that Adam Copeland Christian Cage match like bleed itself into Rampage.
Yes.
It's a smart tactic to implore. But we'll get that again tonight with Rampage following Dynamite. And then Raw Monday night for the second night of the draft, doing 1,683,000 viewers and a 0.55, up 5% in viewership from last week, up 6% in the 18 to 49 demographic. And this was against the NBA. And they did beat the NHL. So they beat everything except for the two NBA games and inside the NBA.
Yes, and we had the return of Braun Strowman, which I do think popped the quarter hour. But yeah, this was on the low end, right, for what Raw has been doing lately after a huge peak for the post-Mania, which was such a big rating. In terms of year-over-year comps, both of these shows, Raw and SmackDown, are still up. If we look down to the monthly comps, are they still up? In April, yeah, we're at the end of April now. So Raw is going to be down. Or in the demo, it's flat, but it is going to be down 4%. And it's been down year over year in each month the last three. But SmackDown is still mostly up.
So, yeah, this week will be with the 3 hours tonight. That is the only AEW programming for the entire week because they will be off Friday. And they
There's no collision.
There's no collision scheduled for Saturday night either. So you'll get a whole week off of AEW programming. And, yeah, tonight is... We will see. I think tonight's Dynamite number is going to be more focused on, if that can be possible, to focus more on 1 week's number than usual. But this is coming off the big angle last week that did a disappointing number last week. But we're going to see if it pays any dividends this week and if all of the coverage that Tony Khan got over the week, positive and negative, generates an audience. They do have Kenny Omega on the show tonight as well. So that's something. And we will see, like, this will be a number that is probably judged more closely as sort of the fallout of last week's angle.
Yes. And do we know sports competition tonight? Is it the usual? Cause we're still in the early rounds of NBA and NHL in terms of what's on, let's say TNT tonight. It is, I don't know.
We've got the Heat and Celtics at 7:30. So that will be a pretty big game. And Rampage will go against the Dallas LA Clippers game that starts at 10. Yes. So two NBA games, that being the key. Here in Canada, they avoided the Toronto Maple Leafs winning in overtime on Tuesday night. So they force a game six on Thursday night here in Canada.
NHL playoffs on ESPN tonight too in the US.
Try to survive. Oh, all right.
And breaking news, TKO has just announced that Mark Shapiro will participate in the JP Morgan Technology, Media, and Communications Conference on May 20th in the morning.
May 20th. Okay. That's Market one day calendars. After May 19th. So I look forward to Mark Shapiro's chat that we will have. Okay. Well, that brings everyone up to speed on everything that is going out there. Again, a thank you to Felix Guti for joining us. You can check out his piece up at postwrestling.com. And a reminder, next week, we will be coming at you on Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern, the day after the TKO earnings call, where maybe Brandon will get a shout out when it is mentioned. Hey, is Vince McMahon leaving the company or is Nick Khan leaving the company? And they can refer everyone to Brandon Thurston, unlocking the fact that these shares that had been offered go back to September.
And well, Pat McAfee has confirmed my analysis as well. Did you see that?
Oh, has he? Okay. Well,
he has sources. I don't know that he looked at the SEC filings, but he says, according to his sources, that is not happening. The sales are not happening. He has listed the shares for sale. I mean, that's absolutely public record, but no.
Did he utter the name Vince McMahon in this reporting?
I don't think so. I retweeted the clip, so it's right there. I don't think. I think he was only talking about Nick Khan.
I don't think he has said Vince McMahon's name since his interview with Nick Khan 2 days before the suit was filed.
But Pat McAfee, you know what I learned from Tony Khan's Harvey Weinstein comment? Well, not that, but the neck brace moment was that, you know, Pat McAfee has no hesitation. Well, it's not really hesitating to talk about AEW. There's clearly not been a directive, at least that he's internalized, to not talk about AEW because, I mean, what did he call them when they referred to Sting retiring, which was nice of them. And they did that right on.
And that was on Raw proper. This isn't on his show.
And what did Pat McAfee was like, yeah, that was epic. Like there are, I mean, Pat McAfee is a big enough star in media that, you know, he's above that radar, right? They're not going to come down on him. As we saw with Norby Williamson, for that matter.
Yeah, and it's gone both ways. I mean, he's had the jabs at AEW on his show WrestleMania week. And then, you know, last week, granted, I was not glued to my Pat McAfee coverage of the NFL draft, but when the clip circulated of him talking about Tony Khan in the neck brace, like, there was such an opening if he wanted to take some shot, and he didn't appear to. He just seemed to have fun with it like everybody else did. So anyway, it's he is a great resource for WWE to have. That's a major voice in sports media and media at large.
Let's do this. I play this. You've mentioned you hear that?
Times there.
Yep.
Nick Khan, there were some internet rumors about him too, selling stock and shares and everything like that. I, after talking to source,
says,
can report some breaking news. That's not true. Has never sold a single share of any stock since getting to the WWE. Hasn't even put them up for sale, which is an entire process to do that. So that was a bunch of bullshit as well. So when you're talking about the WWE climbing, I love that you're going to be around, and I love that Nick Khan is going to be around. The man you've mentioned a few times there, Nick Khan.
Thank you. Okay.
Drew McIntyre seemed just absolutely glued to that and being asked about the stock situation of Nick Khan. I mean, he seemed really excited to talk about that. Okay. Well,
I'm sure he has a lot of thoughts on the options and, you know, the buybacks and so forth.
Yeah, it was interesting to see how far out that reporting got last week, and story that, I mean, if you followed Brandon Thurston, you knew to you could put a fork in that reporting very early on. That will bring it to an end this week's Pollock and Thurston. So thanks for everyone for joining us. Let's do the requisite check that we don't have any lingering mail to be sent our way. But there you go. That's this week's show. Next week, Thursday, 3 Eastern, after the TKO earnings call, let's do our quarterly prediction. Who are the speakers on the call? Do we get beyond the requisite two?
You always get three. You forget. You can't forget Andrew.
Yeah,
Schleimer.
I always
come on
Schleimer. I always forgot about Andrew Schleimer.
Nobody respects CFOs. Come on, they need the proper acknowledgement. Andrew
All
Schleimer.
I hear online is everyone wants CFOs back doing the theme music.
Yes. Oh, there you go.
Okay, I'm done. My jokes have hit their expiration date, as you can state. Okay, so that's coming out. The earnings call Wednesday. We'll be up Thursday, and we will see what else we have to talk about. Maybe a WrestleMania location very, very soon. We'll find out if that means within 7 days or not, but that's it for us. Thanks for tuning in. We'll speak with you next week.